Indian phobia. It started not based on caste. Indian gurus did not do what the Buddhists did. They were making fun of Ram, of Krishna. Is that it justifies the invasion by the Muslims? Caste is the way to go to really hit Hinduism, because caste resonates with race. Pakistan saying that Kashmir is like Palestine. And what was the Ministry of External Affairs doing? They were sleeping. So until then, India was in the good books. What is killing Punjab Sikhs? The Muslims really made friends with the blacks. The only Indians are stupid. Selling out one's culture, selling out one's civilization is too big a price to pay. Jews have been woken up. The Jews behind the scenes have pulled some strings, some powerful strings. Trudeau is in power thanks to the Khalistani support. Indians did not take advantage of it. Pakistanis did. It's a matter of time before Rishi Sunak is kicked out. This thing will happen to the Hindus, not just by the end of this decade, but much sooner. Now, caste quotas may come in international loans. The reason Indians were kicked out is they did not have... China is benefiting from a moron society. And I would say that the RSS has failed the role it should have played. It'll be the end of America. Not even waiting to go to heaven and get 72 virgins. He's got all these girls and his yacht. He's turned his yacht into Jannat, you know.
All right, I'm here. This is an exciting interview for me because this is an interview that I've wanted to take for a while. And I'm talking to a person whose work, for anybody working in our niche, particularly in you know, people in my generation or even younger potentially, his work has been very influential. One of the things that when I talk to people in my niche, Rajivji, a lot of people will point to, you know, Being Different as a book that, you know, really impacted them in their formative years. And I read another book of Rajivji recently called Snakes in the Ganga, which again had a very similar impact on me. And I'm sure a lot of other people as well. So we'll dive into all of that. We'll talk a little bit about Rajivji as well and some of the issues that Rajivji really has been at the forefront of. But before we do any of that, please help me welcome to the show for the very first time, Rajiv Malhotra ji. Rajivji, welcome.
Welcome to you or to my world and my life. And, you know, but we've met each other. We welcomed each other once before at a conference. Yes. And you were just starting out. And yes, you said amazing things. And I said, okay, dekhi jayegi, because a lot of people talk. But you have delivered. I must say, you have delivered and done more than I thought was viable and, you know, reasonable. So I must congratulate you. And I must say that... Bringing me into your life and bringing you into my life is a very important thing, and I'm glad to be here for that reason.
No, thank you. Those are very kind words, and I really do appreciate it. And, you know, I wanted to talk to you because we were talking offline about this, that for some of the issues, particularly in academia, you know, cultural issues that seep into India, the U.S. has become sort of a bellwether for it, you know, particularly American universities. Some of the things that we see in American universities maybe 5 or 6 years ago end up percolating down to Indian universities, Indian academia, even Indian culture and politics 5 or 6 years later. So you've been in the U.S. for a while, and you've been noticing and talking about and fighting many of these things sort of at the forefront for quite a few decades at this point. And so that's why I want to start with you, because one of the real hot-button issues when it comes to the Indian diaspora, particularly the Hindu community in the United States, has now become caste. You know, it's a real hot-button issue. There's academia is chock-full of discussions about it. It's even percolated into, you know, politics, where there are lawmakers considering making, you know, laws specifically singling out caste. But before we dive into all of that, I do want to learn the story about... and I'm sure our audience also does, learn the story about how caste became such a pervasive issue in U.S. academia when discussing India. Was that always the case that India was viewed through the caste lens?
No, that's a fantastic and a very perceptive question. I've lived in the United States since 1971, which means 53 years. And when I came... it was not about caste. India was the land of yoga and meditation and gurus, and it was considered like, you know, this is the mother from where we can learn all kind of good things. It was a positive image, and a lot of Americans who are liberal, who are today on the leftists, at that time, they were hippies. they were going to India to Rishikesh and, you know, all of this stuff. And they were getting meditation from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and all kind of gurus came one after the other. Then later on, a decade later, Osho comes. Then a little bit later, Prabhupada comes. So that was India. India was the land of gurus and yoga and meditation. And America was in crisis. America had all kind of crisis, the Vietnam War, the Watergate scandal, a crisis like today, similar to today. There was a crisis of, hey, we are going nowhere. And India was the land of solutions. Very interesting. Now, at that point in time, you know, Indian gurus did not do what the Buddhists did. They converted a lot of people, a lot of white people into Buddhism. Officially, the Dalai Lama did. But Hindu gurus gave it away without really making them Hindus. Hindu gurus said you can be a Christian or a Jew or anybody, and you can do meditation and you can do breathing and whatnot, and you don't need to convert. So the identity of Hindu did not get importance like the identity of Buddhists did in the United States. This is a very big price we paid, because at that time the whites wanted to convert and the Hindu gurus were not that good at it or didn't know how to do that. Wow. So this business of New Age started. The New Age movement started, and in India and its Hinduism was very popular. Especially, you know, feminists looked at Hindu goddess for inspiration, because in the Abrahamic religions there is no goddess, there is no female prophets, it's all masculine, and so they looked at the Hinduism as a source of inspiration for women who wanted to be spiritual. So it was a very positive era, and you know, then what happened is a lot of the Indian knowledge, the Hindu knowledge, was being plagiarized, was being digested into Christianity. So they were creating Christian yoga, they were creating, you know, meditation, turning it into Christian meditation. So after loving India, they started digesting and incorporating all of that into Western framework, Christian framework, Jewish framework. And this is when I came and started pushing back, saying that, you know, you should acknowledge that this came from India. Why don't you acknowledge? So their response was that, you know, India is primitive, India, and so the attack on Hinduism started with what I called Hindu phobia. It started not based on caste, but they were making fun of deities. They were making fun of Ram, of Krishna. They were making fun of Durga. They were making fun of, Shiva. So all these, this Ganesh is a limp phallus, and, Sri Ramakrishna was a pedophile. He abused Vivekananda. All these kind of things they started doing, and that is when I started calling it Hindu phobia. So at that time, it was not about caste. Those who want to belittle Hinduism would do it on the grounds that it's primitive. They got all these weird idols and gods and goddesses, and these gurus are abusive, whatnot. So it turned into that. That was the first phase. Now what happened is we
Rajesh
pushed...
Ji, sorry to cut across
yeah,
you.
Sure.
Was it happening from these kinds of attacks at that point? Were they happening from academia?
Yes.
Or were
yes,
they happening
yes.
from sort of the Christian right?
The Christian right was always doing these things, but the academia sent anthropologists. If you look at Sarah Caldwell, if you look at all these kind of people, you look at Wendy Doniger, they were sending their students within the academic. Academic Hinduism studies and academic South Asian studies turned toxic against India based on a kind of attack on polytheism and multiple gods and goddesses and being very mean to women. It was those sort of things that took on. Before the left, Indian left joined in and brought caste. This is a very interesting thing. Indian left joined the American Academy and brought in caste. The Indians brought in caste. Before that, you know, we had successfully pushed back the Wendy Donigers, thanks to a lot of the work we did, the first Breaking India book and Hindu phobia and all that. The Western academics were on the back foot, and for a few years they were quiet. But then the Indian leftists joined them, because the Indian leftists started educating them that, you know, you should actually take on caste. You should take on, help bring in Dalits into the American Academy to teach Hinduism. Dalits should be the ones talking about Brahmins and talking about the oppression in Vedas and why Sanskrit is an oppressive language. This something happened in the last 15 years, that a whole lot of Indian leftists from JNU were brought into places like Columbia University, Harvard University. Right now they have Suraj Jengde. He's a product of the Indian left. So if wherever you go in the United States Academy and look at religious studies, you will find Indian leftists and Muslims and Dalits and people who are complaining that women don't have rights in Hinduism. It's all this India Brigade that came here mixed up with the American academics, and they've formed this new coalition. And this coalition has decided, after a lot of trial and error, that caste is the way to go to really hit Hinduism, because caste resonates with race, and Americans have a very big problem with race. They're all race conscious. So if you call somebody a white supremacist, and if you say I'm for blacks, you know, you get a lot of mileage. So why don't we turn that, why don't we use that framework and frame India and Hinduism and based on caste? This is a short view of a long story of how caste became the central strategy of the American left in the academic world.
It's quite curious how caste got conflated with race, because I feel, and you know, people that have maybe studied caste in India or even looked at caste in India sort of at a glance will probably realize that it's quite easy to disprove that, you know, caste doesn't really have anything to do with race. And you'd imagine that in academia, particularly in these Ivy League universities, the humanities departments of these universities, it would be quite easy for academics to, you know, study caste in India and see, well, it doesn't really seem to have anything to do with race or skin color or anything of that matter. So then how come it really has stuck so hard, the whole conflation of caste with race?
Yeah, you know, what you're making is a very important point. I mean, you sit in a classroom and everybody can tell who's black and who's white. But you bring in 20 Indians, nobody can tell this guy's Dalit and he's Brahmin and all that. In fact, I've done that test. I've done that test against the Suraj Engdes and many others like that. Sitting in Princeton University or Harvard or wherever they're doing this, or Columbia, I've asked the whites, I've said, okay, now here, all these Indians, tell me which of them are which caste. Can you tell me? And they're all dumbfounded. But you see, this is logical. This is logical. And they are sort of defying the logic and coming up with this whole theory based on history. And some Dalits have told them that, you know, they were abused in the past and the Brahmins are the oppressors. So you see, the Aryan theory, the Aryan invasion theory, was the first attempt to show that India is actually multiracial. Because if the Aryan theory were valid, then, you know, there's one race coming in and invading. So the reason the Aryan invasion theory is still being proposed and pushed a lot is that it justifies the invasion by the Muslims. When we say Muslims are foreign invaders, they say, well, you know, Hindus are also Aryan invaders. They are the Brahmins. They brought in the Vedas. So you are saying that Muslims brought in, you know, Muslims brought in Persian language and they brought in Islam. And they brought in a foreign race. But do you know that thousands of years earlier, the Aryans, who were also a foreign race, they brought in Sanskrit, they brought in the Vedas. That is the backbone of Hinduism. So you see, the Aryan invasion theory is of strategic value to these people. Because as a defense of foreign Islamic invasion, they can rebuttal and say that that Hinduism itself is a foreign invasion. So the idea of race, India being sort of a dominant race, controlling the local natives and all that, is a part of the strategy. So according to the strategy, the upper castes are the descendants of these Aryans who came, and the Dalits were the original inhabitants. India should belong to them. They are like the Native Americans. They are like the Native Americans. And Hindus are foreigners. So this is how the framing has been done. So the American framing, which says the whites were the oppressors, and the blacks were the oppressed, has been mapped onto the Brahmins are the oppressors, upper caste are the oppressors, the Dalits are the oppressed. And ironically, the Muslims have joined in to say, hey, we are also oppressed. We are also part of the oppressed. That's a strange leftist Islamic coalition, which has become global. And what you are seeing right now in these riots against, Israel and Jews, anti-Semitism all over the place, is the first major global success of this alliance. Mm. This alliance has been built for the last 15 years. After 9/11, the Muslims in this country were on a back foot. There was so much anti-Islam in the United States, anti-Islam, anti-Arab. So that is when Saudis, Qataris, Iranians, they got into the funding game. $5 or $6 billion have been poured into places like Harvard by the Arabs, by the Islamics. Places like Harvard and a few other places, Cornell, Stanford and so on. And they have appropriated the left very meticulously and said, okay, we love Marxism. We love Marxism, which talks about the haves and the have-nots, you know, the bourgeoisie and the proletariats, and we are the proletariats. And this used Palestine as an example to convince the left that the Jews are the dominant culture, they are the oppressors, and the Muslims are the oppressed. And once the left got into bed with the Muslims over is Palestine, then they globalized it. Then they said, okay, even Kashmir is like that. Even Kashmir is where we are the... So you see, first they create a framework, then they expand the framework to apply it on us. So they created this race framework and applied it to... And this Aryan invasion theory framework and applied it to caste. Then they created this framework of, you know, Muslims are our brothers in this fight against all the, you know, people who are the oppressors. And they used Palestine as the case study to do that. And then they expanded it to Kashmir, and Pakistan played this game brilliantly. Pakistan saying that Kashmir is like Palestine because they know that that works well with the left. So these are subtle things that our diplomats don't understand, our gurus don't understand, the people who are speaking as Hindu ambassadors and so on do not generally understand the details of all this. And that's what we've been doing for like 30, 40 years now.
It is interesting how quickly this, you know, the conflation of caste and race, how quickly it's gained sort of mainstream viability in America. Because, you know, you have that book that I want to talk about by Isabel Wilkerson. It's called Caste and the, I can't remember the subheading of that book, but it's called Caste. And, you know, it essentially blames all racism on some sort of a caste system that originates from Hinduism or and India, and it was promoted very heavily by, you know, Oprah, who's a very influential figure in America. You have people like Cornel West, who's a presidential candidate right now and a very, you know, influential figure in the African American community, who promotes these very same ideas. How has it found such mainstream purchase in America?
So, you know, it's very interesting that Martin Luther King was in love with India. He was a follower of Gandhi. He went to India. And I have all his speeches when he came back, what he wrote and so on. And on MSNBC, I was interviewed on a Black Month, you know, Black History Month. They interviewed me. And I talked about the debt the civil rights movement in the United States owes to India. And I played some, we played some of those clips. And they were absolutely amazed. And they said, yeah, this is true. And, you know, after he died, his wife was very fond of India. She used to come for all these India Day parades and things like that. She was really fond of India. So the blacks had a very positive relationship with Indians in the United States. And I one of the scholars we funded, Purushottam Bilimoria, we funded him to document this whole history of Indian influences on African Americans. And we have a whole lot of reports that we haven't published, but we have a whole lot of reports on that. And then I took over this, and the person who was a mentor of Martin Luther King and his mentor before that, I have books on how they loved India. They were part of they were supporting the Indian freedom movement and saying that India is a beacon for freedom for all of the Africans and other people also. So until then, India was in the good books. And then there was this non-aligned movement that during the, you know, Soviet era. And India was the head of the non-aligned movement. And in the non-aligned movement, India was championing the cause of the Africans. India was sort of seen as, you know, the voice of the third world, what they called. So all this changed. Now, this is very interesting. How in the hell did it change? And what were the Indian diplomats doing? And what was the Ministry of External Affairs doing? They were sleeping. And what were all these people who are supposed to be looking at the international affairs from an Indian point of view? What the hell were they doing? So we've been pointing this out. When the Black Lives Matter happened, the blacks were looking for friendship. They only got it from the Muslims. The Muslims really made friends with the blacks. They helped them. They gave them funding. The BLM movement got a lot of funding from the Muslim people, from the Arabs, and because they thought there is a common cause. And the Muslims thought this is their opportunity to counter all the negative anti-Islam stuff that happened after 9/11. You imagine in 9/11, Islam was in the doghouse, and now you cannot criticize Islam, because if you criticize Islam, you're Islamophobic. So in 20 years, I mean, you have to say, wow, these guys are really good at PR. In 20 years, they've turned the tables from being the underdog that were in the shit house, if I may say so. Now they are in the driver's seat, and they're chasing everybody else, going after the Jews, going after the Hindus, and so on. So this has been a remarkable coalition of the left bringing in blacks to champion their case with as a Marxist issue, bringing in Muslims. Then the Dalits have joined in to this woke thing, and now let me tell you. Khalistanis are in.
The Khalistanis are into this woke movement. The Khalistanis are getting a lot of support from the left and from the Muslims. The Muslims, the ISI and all these guys are supporting Khalistanis. So, you know, the Hindu side, Hindu intellectuals need to, I mean, you're one of the few who's really showing interest in this, but we are looking for people to take this matter seriously for quite a long time.
It's quite incredible. Like, you know, I want to touch on the Khalistan issue a little bit too, because it's quite incredible how the Khalistani movement has been able to ingratiate itself into this, you know, BLM woke movement. Because if you think about it, if there's one sort of movement that's really based around caste identity, it is Khalistan. You know,
of course.
Khalistanis are mainly comprised of the dominant Jat caste. Yeah.
Jat. The Jat are the Khalistani, and they are very caste-conscious people. They are not oppressed. I mean, the Sikhs are among the most affluent people in India. Come on, Sikhs are the most affluent. But, you know, I found there is a whole scam going on. In Canada, they have a fast track for refugee status. If you can claim that your community is being abused and human rights violations against you and your life is in danger, if you can show that, then you get Canadian, you know, immigration and all that very quickly. So this was set up to bring in, you know, people like Tibetans and certain people like that. But the Khalistanis, they've got clever lawyers and they've lobbied with the Canadian government, Trudeau and all these people, and to classify themselves as endangered in India. They are endangered in India, according to them. Okay. And so when I went to one of these Sikh Gurdwaras, I was brought in and they all started booing me. They started saying, oh, RSS has come, Brahmin has come and whatnot, oppressor. I said, firstly, I'm not RSS and I'm not Brahmin, but I will talk to you about whatever you want. So then they started saying that you have oppressed our people, you are killing our people and whatnot in Punjab. That's what they said. So first I decided that they're so rude and so crude that I don't even want to stay here. But my host convinced them to keep quiet and listen to me, listen to my side of it. So then when I got the floor, I said, do you know what is the number one problem in Punjab? What is killing Punjab Sikhs in the villages? What? And they were all quiet. I said, it's drugs. Mm. And drugs are not supplied by Brahmins and it's not RSS supplying you drugs. You know where drugs come from. They come from across the Pakistan border. And did you guys ever complain about that? And then I said, do you know what is the second biggest crisis in Punjab such that in 20 years, you'll have very few Sikhs left? And they all looked like that, Rachel. I said, church evangelism is more aggressive in Punjab than anywhere else. There are more Sikhs being converted to Christianity than in any other part of India. And this is not something RSS is doing. This is not something Brahmins are doing. So between the crisis that you're facing with drugs and the crisis you're facing with conversion, your next generation is finished. And the World Council of Churches has announced very officially that by 2030, they want more churches than Gurdwaras in Punjab. And they want that the total number of people attending church every week should be more than the total number of people attending Gurdwaras. So guess what? That is how you're being finished off, and you're a bunch of stupid people actually fighting against the Hindus when you don't know that that Hindus would be the ones protecting you. So you see, they were stunned because nobody knew all this. But then, you know, what happens is many of these Khalistani, these rabbit type people, they're not very well educated. They are these Gunda type people. They're not, you know, you have the very sophisticated Sikhs and I have a lot of friends like that. Unfortunately, the Sikhs are talking from both sides. They are very Hindu friendly. Like we recently had Diwali, some of them showed up and they were very nice guys. But, you know, the same guys also fund the Gurdwara where the money goes to Khalistan. So money from American Gurdwaras goes through various pipelines here and there, Canadian, Australian, British, and ends up in the for funding all this Khalistani stuff. But the ideology of Marxism and wokeism and this Islam as a sort of underdog ideology has been used to bring Khalistanis on board and make them one of the partners in this alliance.
But isn't that not a big indictment of the level of academia in these universities, that there is not a more close examination of the Khalistani movement? You know, because if they have sympathies for the Khalistani movement, then I think it behooves them to study the Khalistani movement or who the Khalistanis are a little bit more closely. And I feel like even just a cursory examination of the Khalistani movement will reveal that this is a very caste-based, a very casteist movement. you know, and you look at the kind of land that they, that the Jats control in Punjab, you look at the kind of land that the Dalit Sikhs control in Punjab, it's nowhere near comparable. And if you're going to include this movement that is comprised of these dominant caste Sikhs, then maybe a closer examination should be warranted, but it's not happening. Why is that?
So your question is exactly where I was at 30 years ago when I thought the academy is honest and academy asks honest questions, which is what you are saying. And I was funding Harvard. We are just doing, you know, we are doing our 30th anniversary next year. And so we're going to come up with a book on the history of Infinity Foundation. And so I'm going back and looking at all the archives, looking at how we funded Harvard, why we funded Harvard, why we funded Columbia, why we funded University of California, why we funded, you know, all these kind of big universities, and how I was so sure that I will bring these issues to them and they will be honest academicians. I found that they're neither honest nor intellectually that great and intelligent. People like you and I, if we really put our mind to it and study something, we can produce better scholarship with rigor and all that. We can produce better scholarship and more honest. So I decided, that's when I decided to hell with them after giving millions of dollars to them. But it took me 10 years and several million dollars of funding and getting very intimate with the American Academy, becoming an insider. I was considered a very important person. I was a member of many of their committees, and I was organizing conferences and funding PhDs and lecture series and all that, textbooks and whatnot. After doing all that, I realized that they are so deeply biased politically, and their strings are being pulled from people who got tons of money, a lot more than some ordinary guy like me. So the academics are for sale. This is true for the social sciences and humanities. If Indians want to, Indian billionaires want to fund the U.S. Academy, they should fund some engineering and some computer science, some, you know, AI, those kind of things, which tend to be less ideological, and maybe we can get more value out of it. The Chinese are doing that. They're funding STEM in order to get technology, American technology, in order to steal American technology. They're not funding humanities. There's no Chinese funding on China studies, on Tibet, on Uyghurs, on Taiwan. They don't want that. They don't want anybody to talk about it. They think they are the only ones who should talk about it. And the last thing they will do is to give money to people who want to discuss such things. Only Indians are stupid in that our billionaires are going around funding. I mean, the Mahindras and the Lakshmi Mittals and the Tatas and the Reliance Ambanis and all, they are the ones who are going around funding the very anti-India, anti-Hindu forces in places like Harvard. So So you see, when you look at what's wrong with the academy, you also have to say what's wrong with our own billionaires who go there and fund all this. And why aren't the Indian professors who are fully tenured, their jobs are protected, why aren't in these universities, why aren't they able to raise the voice the way Muslims do? When it's an issue of Islam, when it's an issue of African Americans, and when it's an issue of Judaism, right now Jewish scholars are standing up and raising hell. They are raising hell in these universities. And Jewish funding, you know, Jewish billionaires have gone public and said, I'm not going to fund Harvard. I'm not going to fund UPenn. I'm not going to fund Cornell. Why haven't the Indian billionaires stood up and said, until this caste nonsense stops from the Ivy Leagues, we are not going to fund them one more penny, and we're not going to give them our family name to put on a center called Mahindra Center or Mittal Center or something, which is an insult to our country. So you have to also take the blame of what's going on and go further and look at the role of our own people who are sponsoring all this.
It seems to me, you know, I was reading your book, and you talked about, like, you know, a few years ago, you did do some reach out to some of these billionaires. I think there was an example of an industrialist. I can't remember their name.
Was it Adani Ambani? No, I had a couple of meetings with Mahindra. Met him. I have met Piramal. I have met him personally in the Piramal Towers upstairs. Very nice guys, extremely decent gentlemen, very sweet. And, you know, I'm shocked that while they are Desh Bhakt in India, and the Indians idolize them, okay, and we give them all these awards and they're very famous, yet when they go overseas, they want to be in the liberal white, leftist white camp and be seen as one of the honorary whites. You know, they want to join this board and have Bill Gates sitting there and Warren Buffett, and they want to talk like we're one of you. So they want to buy their way into international elitism. And of course, it also helps get their family member into admission into these Ivy Leagues. Right. And, you know, and it probably is good for business because in the sense they cut joint ventures and technology deals here and there because they're hobnobbing with big industrialists. But I think selling out one's culture, selling out one's civilization is too big a price to pay, no matter how much selfish gain they're getting.
Yeah, and that's fair. And, you know, to be fair to the Indians, and we've criticized them plenty, but to be fair to them, I do want to say that it does seem like even the American center and the American right has been caught completely blindsided by the sort of the level of infiltration that they've seen in American media and academia by the Islamists, by the Marxists, by the leftists. I mean, they've seen pretty blindsided as well. I mean, I live in America, you live in America. I'm sure we've seen on social media and in the news the level of shock that I suppose the common American has expressed at the amount of support that American universities and Gen Z students are showing, you know, Palestine and even Hamas for that matter. You know, people are, I see a lot of these videos of students, you know, talking about Hamas, talking about ceasefire, but not one of them I see talking about saying, okay, well, Hamas needs to first release the hostages, lay down their arms and surrender, and then let's have the ceasefire. So even the American center and right have been blindsided by this.
Yes. So, you know, in New Jersey, we have a Hindu-Jewish coalition. This was founded about 10, 15 years ago. And I'm one of the two Hindus and there are two Jews and we founded this. Then we had a summit of top rabbis and top gurus. And we had these summits going on to discuss mutual relations and so on. So all these years, when I would write these books and bring them to the attention of the Hindu-Jewish coalition, and when I would talk about this wokeism and the left and the global left and how they are doing all this stuff, I mean, they would appreciate me as on a personal level, but they didn't want to put their name on it. It was too controversial. I mean, now, ever since Israel got attacked, now I'm giving call and say, hey, listen, you were telling us this all wrong. You were telling us this. Right. You were talking about the global left all wrong. And, you know, we didn't know that this is so serious. So in a way, I mean, there's a silver lining. I'm very saddened that so many people are dying and very horrible that war is going on. But one good thing that's coming out of it is that the Jews have been woken up. And when the Jews are woken up in this country, they do have power. They do have clout. They do have money. They control a lot of the politicians who run for Senate and Congress and all that. And I'm privy to some of the stuff that's going on, how they're going to pull the strings here, there, behind the scenes. They are the ones who are making sure that CNN has got some balance. MSNBC, not so. Fox, of course, would be on their side. CNN, if you have noticed, CNN has sent several people to Israel to cover the Israeli point of view. And this is very new for CNN to do. And it's because the Jews behind the scenes have pulled some strings, some powerful strings. So you see, what's happened is all of a sudden, I'm saying, hey, you know what? You got to, when you're fighting against anti-Semitism, you also have to fight against Hinduphobia. You guys have to fight against, because we got a common source of the problem, common ideology, common enemy, and the Jews are now interested. So I'm having some traction in this Hindu-Jewish thing, not just having nice cocktail parties and celebrating some religious festivals and all that, which is a beautiful thing to do, but also talking about the geopolitical realities. So I think the wake-up call that the Jews have is going to produce some effects beyond just the local Israel-Palestine fight. I think it's going to wake up a lot of people around the world that this is how powerful the alliance of the global left and global Islam has become.
And it is quite strong. And, you know, it's even more strong, I imagine, in Europe. Like in the United States, it's such a large country and it has a very small Muslim population. But in Europe, in particularly countries like France, countries like Britain, we've seen like massive demonstrations across London, in Paris, in the Netherlands, and in Belgium, and places like that. And for them, it must be quite a scary proposition as well to see that while they've just been sitting around twiddling their thumbs, there is another, this pillar that has become a threat to their democracy, have sort of just sprung up right under their noses. And now it's almost, in some countries, they might even feel that it's too big to do anything about.
Yeah. So what has happened, like, for example, we know, everybody knows that in Canada, the Khalistani supported political party has enough MPs that their support is needed by Trudeau. Trudeau is in power thanks to the Khalistani support. So that's happening in Britain and France also, that there are these Muslim groups that are supporting the Labour Party in Britain. And it's a matter of time before Rishi Sunak is kicked out. I mean, this will happen. It's not going to last very long because these forces are gathering momentum and they're coming together. So if the Labour Party came in, you might see the mayor of London, who's a Pakistani Muslim, you might see him as the next prime minister. Already, the top guy in the parliament in Scotland is one of those guys. I was there, and they told me we cannot even speak openly. The Hindu said, even in a gathering which is meant to be multicultural, multi-religious, pluralism, even in a government body which is meant to create religious harmony, the Hindu representative herself told me that if she says something that says Hindu phobia should be put on par with Islamophobia, something like that, and she's going to be reprimanded. So, you know, it's very, this brings me to another point. Islamophobia is becoming a huge topic, and there's government support. There are laws coming out, banning, criminalizing Islamophobia, but not the same thing for Hindu phobia.
Yeah, it is. It is quite interesting. And again, it says how deeply embedded, the Islamists have become with the Marxists and the left academia in these universities as well. I remember an anecdote, actually. You spoke about the Scottish guy. And I remember an anecdote where he was, it again shows the sort of leftist Islamist nexus, where he was giving a speech in the Scottish Parliament. And I imagine Scotland, I imagine, is like a 90%+ white country. And he was talking about how it's a complete travesty of justice that the chief justice is white, the chief of police is white, and the so-and-so, a lot of these people in top positions of authority are white. And I was thinking to myself, this is, almost a 95% white country. What do you expect?
I mean, it's like
why is the chief justice of India not from Uganda?
No. Or why is it that 90% of the top leaders in Saudi Arabia are Muslims and they're Arabs? Why are they so? Why aren't there white people from Ireland, and why aren't there Chinese running the show? And in Iran, why are they all mullahs and all these kind of people who are in top positions? And why isn't the Iranian military run by Jews? I mean, it's so ridiculous, so stupid. But the fact that they get away with it, it shows the amount of white guilt. You see, there is white guilt in the United States vis-a-vis the blacks. And in Britain, there is white guilt vis-a-vis colonized people like India. But Indians did not take advantage of it. Pakistanis did. Pakistanis really play on this colonizer guilt, that you were the colonizers, oppressed my people. And you are this liberal guy, and your redemption lies in hating your own culture and supporting me. Hindus never went for that. Hindus are more interested, we'll go into IT and we'll become doctors and we'll have soft power and we'll go into yoga. And Indians have not understood the importance of grabbing hard power.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something very disturbing. Yeah. There are security services which are offering the security in airports, in hotels, railway stations, security in the government. There are a lot of security is a very large career. It's a very large career to get a degree in security and get a job which makes you one of the insiders into the whole security apparatus. And somebody told me that in Canada, and also when I went to England, someone told me the same thing there also, there are organizations that recruit people in the mosques, Muslims, recruit people in the mosques, and Khalistani young boys, and they train them, they get them certified as security officers. And then they help them get jobs into security, because the idea being that in the next 5 years, they want to dominate, so that when you're going through any security, chance will be that most of the time it will be their people who will be checking you out. Okay. And their people will be deciding who's risky and who's not risky. So this is happening in the, so things are going to get worse because our people are sleeping. So they are getting into security as a career, which is, does not require a whole lot of brains. It's not like mathematics and all that. But you can, if you are a reasonably smart guy, you can get a degree, and there are a lot of jobs in this. That is one area that this coalition, the left, has strategized this and brought a lot of Muslims, blacks, and Khalistanis and Dalits into this career. Another career is the corporate career called DEI, Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, which is a big fashion in India also. You go to any of the big Bombay industrial houses, and they all got, in the HR department, they got somebody in charge of DEI. And what does DEI mean? It sounds very nice. We all want diversity. We all want inclusion. That's the Hindu way. But in practice, the people who are being certified to be qualified for jobs, the certification is being controlled, just like halal certification. The certification of who are the candidates that ought to be given these jobs is being controlled by these people, the same people that we are up against. They are controlling, and they're getting their young men and women by the thousands to get in, get certified, and then they help get them jobs. So typically the DEI officer very rarely is a practicing Hindu who's proud to be a Hindu. If he's a Hindu, he's a Marxist. Generally, if he's a Hindu, he's a Dalit, or he's often a Muslim, or he's a Christian, or something like that, something secular. So the DEI officer in the corporate world, all over the world, is a part of the strategy of wokeism to get their people into the corporate positions. And the security apparatus in all these different countries is another place to get their people in. So what you are going to see within the next 3 to 5 years is this whole issue, arouse million people into violence, into protest, into demonstrations all over, you're going to see this get even worse. Much worse. Yeah. It's not going to remain in campuses. It's going to get into the corporate world. It's going to get into the security apparatus. It's going to get into the governments. And this is happening at a very rapid pace.
And that's another example of, like we were talking about earlier, that, something that's fashionable in America will then 5 or 6 years later percolate into Indian academia, or now in that the example that you're talking about, into Indian businesses. And again, yes, it's very dangerous.
Yes. And, in the British police, how many of the new recruits are older people are mostly the senior guys are still white. But how many Muslims are getting in? It's just absolutely amazing. And they're very proud of it. They're saying, this is our strategy. You can own IT. You write all the software and all that stuff. And you can be the doctors, and you can teach yoga and all that. But we will run the police. And this is what happened in Kenya, when the reason Indians were kicked out is they did not have hard power. There were no Indians in military, in police, in government, judges and all that. They were all people who were on the other side. So Idi Amin, like that, could kick out all the Indians. So the same situation is facing Hindus. What is now happening against Jews? It's a matter of time where a similar clash will be created, and then we will hit back against the other side, and then this will erupt all over the world. All over the world, this will erupt anti-Hindu, anti-India, the way it is now anti-Jews. This is waiting to happen, and I just want to tell my audience that what is now been done to the Jews is a test case. This thing will happen to the Hindus, not just by the end of this decade, but much sooner.
Yeah, and we've seen a small example of that already. You're talking about power. If you look at what's happened in California and Washington over the last couple of years, that's a very good example of how this wokeism is directly impacting the lives of Indian Americans, and particularly Hindu Americans now. The one of the more prominent cases was the Cisco case that was filed against two Indian Americans on the basis that they were, discriminating on the basis of caste, and the Californian government got involved and filed a case against these people. Luckily, these people were exonerated, and they found no evidence of wrongdoing. However, there was a group called Equality Labs whose pseudoscientific survey was the one that was used to file the case. And even though the case got thrown out, that same survey was used then in Seattle, in Washington State in America, to pass a resolution where they were including, caste as a protected category. Even in California, there was a Democrat lawmaker, Aisha Wahab, that was trying to pass SB 403 that will ban discrimination on the basis of caste, even though, any discrimination based on ancestry or national origin or anything like that is already illegal in America.
Right,
so this law is essentially, Rajiv Ji, like putting a hat on a hat. The point putting a hat on a hat. The point is singling out the Indian American, particularly the Hindu Americans, and, kind of quote unquote, showing them their place.
Right. And, it's even worse. Equality Labs has been giving seminars in UN bodies, in World Bank, in IMF.
Incredible.
So I got a copy of the 6-part seminar on caste sensitivity, which they did at the World Bank. I got a copy of that. It was done for their people. And people from all over the world who are members in the World Bank, they attended this. And Sondere Rajan, the lady who runs this Equality Labs, personally conducted these. Okay. And I have a copy of that. And what all nonsense and rubbish she talks about caste and Hinduism and whatnot. Now, their argument, their reason for sensitizing World Bank on caste was to say that before you give loans for development purposes in another country, you should check out and see what is the caste representation. So now caste quotas may come. Now caste quotas may come in international loans. So what happens now? So if you want your company to be rated well for international loans and international financing and all international investments, you'll have to comply with these people. People like Equality Labs to get a good certificate from them. The whole certification, whether it is certifying people to be security officers in some security thing, or to be DEI diversity officers in HR, or to be compliant for financial loans and all that. You know, these kind of certifications are being controlled. So this nexus of woke is very, very intelligent, very smart. They decided that they'll control the different certifications, the different professions through which they will channel their people. And youth have got a lot of unemployment all over the world. And so youth will gravitate through these programs to get jobs. And so you will see very quickly a flood of such people taking over various industries.
Yeah. It is quite incredible how strongly they've been able to do that. And you know, in California, I think the Indian American community got a little bit fortunate that the governor was able to veto the law. But I don't think it's going to stop there.
But you know, that happened because, again, I'll just tell you the backstory. A few who did not want to be named, but serious people with money,
right,
who are funding these politicians, made it very clear to them that this will be a very big mess. And they just took the easy way out, saying, okay, it's not because Newman loves Hindus or anything. Right. It's just that they have to look at their political equation, you know?
Yeah. So clearly, you know, like you said, it's not like they love the Hindus or anything like that. So it's not like it's going to stop. And I was reading that in Massachusetts or New Jersey or something like that, they were thinking, some politicians were talking about bringing a law that, you know, they were trying to pass in California. So it's going to start happening in different states across the United States. And before you know it, you know, you look at talking about things that are happening in the U.S., then transporting to India. And if you look at India right now, it's a very similar thing that's happening, where they're talking about this caste census. And Rahul Gandhi is touring the country talking about jitni abadi utna haq. Now, on the face of it, Rajivji, I don't have a problem with the caste census, because it can also help you, you know, find out how many people of each caste live there, so you can provide targeted, you know, benefits to them, targeted government programs to them. On that face, it might make sense. But what Rahul Gandhi is saying specifically is very dangerous. Jitni abadi utna haq, which means that, you know, it kind of is incentivizing, if you look at it, the Muslim community to increase their numbers in India.
Basically, it's the end of meritocracy.
Yes.
It is the end of meritocracy. It basically means that we'll have a certain percentage quota, even if you are useless. But that you know, so would you want your surgery to be done by a doctor who got this job as a surgeon based on some quota? Would you want to fly an airplane or in an airplane as a passenger and find out that the pilot he was a useless fellow, but he got bonus marks to get through the pilot exam because he was from a certain identity? I mean, the point is, you don't create a good world-class cricket team based on quota. By the way, I watched the semi-finals today, and what a great 397 runs score of the Indians. And congratulations to Virat Kohli for scoring the largest number of centuries in ODI. So I just saw that a little while back. You cannot create a world-class military. Any competitive arena where you have a team and there are other teams, whether it is sports or whatever, you cannot have the world's best. You cannot perform very well in Olympics or whatever if your teams are constrained not by merit, but by some identity politics. So the moment identity politics enters a society and start spreading from there, it's going to be the end. It's like the cancer from within, and it's going to destroy the society from within. And guess right. who is laughing at all this? China. Because China don't allow any of this bullshit in China. And they're very happy. TikTok promotes all this yeah. in foreign countries. But within China, TikTok is very much about education and about their space program and about science and very serious stuff that, you know, they're proud to expose their children to. So the right. Mandarin version of TikTok content is very different. English version is all this silly, stupid stuff to more make people into morons and dumb them down. So China is benefiting from a moron society, angry and fighting each other over hierarchy of power and all that, and quotas of identities, because they know that this is the way you finish off people. So the Chinese right. are... Chinese are benefiting from this. Nobody else is benefiting. It's not the Dalits who are going to come out ahead or anything. It's not that the Palestinian, average Palestinian is going to come out ahead. Hamas is living. Hamas has got, by the way, Hamas has a few billionaires. I don't know if you read this. The one guy who's ahead, his net worth is $5 billion. He's living right. in Qatar. I mean, he's got a private yacht. He's living all that lifestyle. You see, so, I mean, not even waiting to go to heaven and get 72 virgins, he's got all these girls and his yacht. He's turned his yacht into Jannat, you know.
Heaven on earth, yeah.
He's a heaven on earth. So I think there's so much hypocrisy in all this, that it is good shows like you are there to call out this hypocrisy with courage, with audacity, and I say kudos to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, sir. And just finally, I want to do another quick round with you, but wrapping up this segment, if I were to ask you to provide a bullet point of recommendations to A, the average Indian, and B, the Indian government, what would those be?
See, the average Indian should stop deifying the billionaires blindly. They should put some conditions. They should say that we are the consumers who are making you billions of dollars rich, and then you are using this money in various ways. So we have a say as consumers. We have choices. I can buy your car or somebody else's car. I can buy something from this fellow or that fellow. We need to have our NGOs become more active in making people conscious consumers of these billionaires. I think that would work. We should also have there is a service we are going to start in Infinity Foundation. I don't want to announce it or discuss it yet, but we will start something to inform the public about all these things in a more systematic way, in a more rigorous right. way. As far as government is concerned, the government cannot tell Mahindra how to spend his money. It's his money. He can do whatever he wants. But government can certainly say, let's talk about it. What is your goal? What are you trying to get? Can you please come and read this book, Snakes in the Ganga, and respond to all the allegations being made about you? Can you just tell us what your thoughts are? Why are you doing all this? We are fighting. Our ambassador is fighting all this woke and left anti-India and all these human rights allegations. We are fighting all that on the one hand. And you are funding the very people who are creating all this. What is this right. going on? We have to reconcile. So I think this requires a little bit of courage. And I would say that RSS has failed the role it should have played. RSS has the hold over the Hindu public. They have the reputation, the clout, they have the kind of a mandate, if you will, as the umbrella that can bring all the Hindu groups together. And they aren't doing that. They're doing a great job with their own foot soldiers in the villages, at the grassroots, holding society together, creating values and fighting conversion, bringing Ghar Vapsi, all those people back. Those are fantastic. And whenever I meet their leaders, I'm very happy because they're very good people on a personal level. But I think they could do more. Their international wing, let's just say, maybe the domestic wing in India is doing well, but their international wing that is within the diaspora could do a lot more in terms of going after these sort of issues. If they can't do it and they don't have the qualified people, they could support people like you and me. They could give some, we're not, it's not money and all, but there are ways they could help. There are ways they could facilitate so that those who are already doing this, who've stuck their neck out, who've given their tan, man, dhan towards this, get some backing, some sense of support. So I think the Indian government could do all of those things. I have even proposed to the ICCR, Indian Council of Cultural Relations. Sahasra Buddheji is the head now. He knows me. Before that, Lokesh Chandra was a good friend of mine. We gave him the Lifetime Achievement Award. He was the head of that. So since way back, I've been proposing to them that I would like to do a 1 or 2 day conference on the state of India studies in the American Academy every year. And we will tell you what, who's doing what in the American Academy, because we're monitoring these people. We'll tell you right. which professor were writing this and that, and what's going on campuses and whatnot. What are the different groups doing in various campuses? And we will do a conference where we will invite them to come and respond. If they want to respond, they can respond. At least it'll become a topic of conversation. At least those people will know that they are being watched. Somebody is watching. Now, the Jews have a campus watch. They have something called campus watch. Yeah. Where they are monitoring these things in a very systematic way, and there is a national headquarters, and then these people getting support, getting funding to do all this monitoring and surveillance, and then they publish, and they have vigilance of their own. So we have nothing of that sort, and I have proposed this for like 15 years. So these are some of the things the authorities could do to help us out.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I want to do a quick rapid fire round with you before I let you go, Rajivji, if you have another 10 minutes to spare.
Sure.
I want to ask you a few questions, and I want you to give a, you know, quick answer as quickly as you're able to. So my first question for you is, according to you, what is the worst trend that you find in the United States right now?
Wokeism. Wokeism is the worst trend in the United States. It'll be the end of America.
What is the silliest or dumbest political or cultural opinion or narrative in India at the moment?
The narrative that appeasement continues. It has become a little less, but the narrative of appeasement, which is in every single party without exception, some worse than others, that I think is the silliest narrative.
What is the biggest issue facing India today?
Overpopulation and pandering to identities is the overarching. Because, you know, India is very proud that we have so many 100 million free houses, so many 100 million people get gas, so many 100 million people get free this, that. But the fact that you have to give them free shows there's a problem, that they're not able to pay for it themselves.
What gives you the most amount of hope for India?
I think the Indian youth have had it. The Indian youth are fed up. The Indian youth are beginning to speak up, people like you. And I feel that we are creating good future leaders, much better than my generation had.
Well, that's good to hear. What is your favorite genre to read?
Well, I read philosophy. That is my favorite genre. Philosophy and history. Philosophy, history, spirituality, all of these mixed up. That's my genre.
Do you watch any movies or TV shows?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my wife makes sure that once in a while. Mornings are mine. Right. I get up. Evenings are hers. She's a late night person. So we watch some fun movies all the time. I just watched this series called Kora. It's a 6-part series about Punjab. It's on Netflix. A very exciting show.
Oh, wow. That was going to be my other question. What is your current favorite movie or TV show?
Well, that is one TV show. I also enjoy watching historical, like Ottomans. There's a 6-part Ottomans on one of these Prime or somewhere. Vlad, who was this Dracula, is a show on him. Historical, you know, fictionalized, but this is accurate history. I do know the history, so I can verify it, and I like that. Because I've studied the West and China and Arabs, and I like to study all cultures, not just my own, and therefore I enjoy this.
Do you have a guilty pleasure movie or TV show that you really enjoy, but you're slightly embarrassed about?
No, I don't think I'm embarrassed. I mean, the thing is, I'm pretty mad dheet aadmi hu. I'm stubborn.
That's a good attitude.
And, I just let it all out, you know. But that makes me very controversial, and a lot of people feel uncomfortable, but that's okay.
Right. What is a movie or a TV show or a book or any piece of media that everyone likes but you think is quite overrated?
I think in my generation, it used to be things like The Discovery of India, which is very overrated.
Right.
You know, that kind of a thing. I feel that this is going to be bad for me politically, but I think that Republic, Goswami, Arnab Goswami, given how much stature he has, he has failed to do deep, like you're doing a deep dive right now. Okay.
Right.
But, you know, I turn down all these offers to go to his show. They keep calling me because I don't want to be in this big tamasha with 10 other people. Nobody, nothing deep, all very superficial scandal and sensation and all that. So I think that is overrated because India needs better than that.
Yeah, I think and a one-on-one, you know, conversation where you're really able to, because on a panel like that, you know, you're already fighting to get your voice heard. And so you're trying and they encourage you, I feel like, to say the more controversial opinions so that they can be put on social media and they can get clicks and stuff like that. So A, you can't be heard. You have to fight to get heard. And B, you have to try and say the most controversial things possible. So it's difficult to, you know, really understand how the person thinks, where they're coming from, you know, how their mind works. And what the, you know, what the core of the issues are in like a 10-minute segment like that, as opposed to something like this. What will the name of the movie that is made on your life be?
Quest for Infinity.
That's a good one. Like
yeah,
that one.
It's a quest, but it's a quest.
Yes.
Not claiming to have reached there, but right. Quest for Infinity, nothing less than that.
Right. What real life character, current or historical, would you like to see a movie or TV show made about?
You know, in the Mahabharata, they praise many other characters, but my favorite is Dronacharya. Because I think that's a very enigmatic, person, very complex person. You don't need only a hero; you can have anti-heroes. But understanding the good side, the bad side, the ego side, you know, the power side, and also the brilliance. Is important for today. We need to understand that kind of a mind better today. And we are only glorifying certain, positive deities and those kind of people, which is important for bhakti. But I think we also need to know, there is stuff on Ravan and all that, but there should be on more of these other people who could be anti-heroes or whatever you want to call them.
Right. What is your favorite genre of music?
And by the way, Dronacharya, before I leave...
Sure.
A tough guy coach, no nonsense, kick-ass coach,
yeah.
Is good. Not the pampering type, you know.
Yes.
So I think there are good things about it. He's a rough guy, but there are good things about some tough. We need almost like a danda coach, danda type education system where, people need to go through boot camp.
Yeah.
Sort of like a boot camp to toughen them up.
Yeah.
And that is Dronacharya's boot camp. That's what I like.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe that's a good movie. Dronacharya's Boot Camp.
Dronacharya's Boot Camp. That could be even a good course to develop, you know, for diaspora kids. That's a good course to develop
I started something called Diksha, Dharma Intellectual Kshatriya Academy. And then I thought Dharma should be Dronacharya.
Right.
Diksha. But we didn't get any support, but we have the material and we're going to write a book on that. We're producing a book for 2024 on the education system.
Oh, that's wonderful. That'd be great. Yeah. I think a course like that, you know, especially for diaspora kids, I think that could be quite good. Your favorite genre of music and your current favorite song?
Oh, I don't have a current favorite song, but I like jazz, actually. I like indie music, of course. I like Bollywood, and I love all these, the oldies, my generation, the big hitters, the big singers, you know, of my generation who are no more. All of them, with the end of Lata, there's no more left. But I also like jazz a lot. I like this counterculture. You know, jazz did something important to American culture because it shook up this very white, rigid, regimented, formal thing. And then there were people like Elvis who brought black music into the white society. And now white music has become changed, you know, with a whole lot of chaos. What they were afraid of, the FBI called it chaos and the end of America. That when they attacked, Elvis, they said that this kind of a thing is bad for white people. But jazz continued. In a form that is very nice and gentle and good, but also it shakes up the traditional classical, the Western style of music. So I like that a lot. I enjoy it a lot, and I like to go to jazz clubs.
Right. What is your... I have just a couple more questions for you, and then I'll let you go, I promise. What is your favorite town in India?
Oh, my favorite town in India, I would say I have great memories in... Rishikesh. I have great memories in Rishikesh. I also have a lot of good memories in Goa. And in Tamil Nadu, you know, during the 2005 tsunami, I spent 3 months in Nagapattinam village. And I loved it. I lived with those fishermen. We had those very traditional kind of style of eating. And we shot a documentary on the tsunami and the church, the role of the church and foreign NGOs and whatnot. We did that. And I really got to know those people. But, you know, those were transient. I never got to go back and spend too much time. Right. I always love to go to Rishikesh. There's so many nice things there. And that's a good place. I would love to retire maybe or just live there forever.
Oh,
or for a few more years at least. forever is asking too much.
And, forever is and a very long time.
A long time, and you don't want to wish that either, because it can be quite a miserable. I mean, old age can be quite miserable. So I just want to live a few more years, I should say, but right. Live nicely.
No, that's wonderful, and that's a great place to leave it for the day. I appreciate you, Rajiv ji, for taking the time out to speak to me today about a topic that, you know, I find very important. And I'm sure, you know, our audience listening to this will find it important as well. So thank you for your explainer. Thank you for your insight on all of these topics today. And thank you for joining me.
And I want to say that I send you my love, blessings, all the good wishes. I want young people like you who are bright, smart, articulate, no nonsense, not afraid, able to grasp the big picture, put it out there. I want such people. I want more such people. You've done a phenomenal job. And I tell you, I have to tell you this very honestly. When I first saw you, it wasn't that far back. It was in Chicago, that big event. I didn't anticipate that you will actually achieve this kind of great heights. And I'm so proud of you. More power to you. And let's hope we'll do some more of these fun things together.
Yes, absolutely. I'd love to collaborate on shows like this and on any projects that you may have any interest in as well. I'm always available. I'm always open to collaboration. So yeah, I look forward to it. And please, before we wrap up, let our audience know where they can find you on social media or on the platforms.
So the website rajivmalhotra.com, we are updating. It is being updated in a month or two. We'll have a brand new one which is being created, but the current one is fine. You can get all my books and all the videos and all of that stuff in rajivmalhotra.com. On social media, Rajiv Message on Twitter, and on YouTube and Facebook, it is Infinity Foundation Official. Or Rajiv Malhotra Official. Those are the places to find me. And I look forward to hearing from all you guys, wonderful listeners, and look forward to more interactions on this show. Namaste to everybody.